Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It is Wednesday, the 10th of February. Good morning and welcome to Africa Link, coming to you from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I am Jen Ayeko-Kumet. Coming up in our program today, South Africa's top court hears President Jacob Zuma's case on excessive public funds spent on his private Nkandla home.
We want rule of law to take its course. In fact, as Congress of the People, we wish that he must just step down. He has failed and failed the country at large.
Fighting for their rights and protection, Guinean journalists observe a press-free day after the murder of one of their colleagues.
It's totally understandable that journalists and supporters of press freedom would want to protest in support of improving the conditions facing those in the profession.
And we shall also be hearing a story of one Cameroonian man who is combating terror recruitment by empowering the youth. These stories and more coming up shortly.
Top story.
Nkandla has over time become popular, more so in South Africa. The reason? President Jacob Zuma's private home. $23 million from public coffers was used to upgrade it. This did not go well with the public that demanded that the president pays back the money. As the president remained adamant to public outrage, two political parties, Economic Freedom Fighters and Democratic Alliance, took Zuma to the Constitutional Court to force him to pay. The court had the case on Tuesday, and as Tuso Kumalo reports, it was a conference of legal minds.
The proceeding in the court can simply be described as a clash of legal minds. There were strong arguments and counter-argument by both legal teams representing President Jacob Zuma and the two opposition parties that filed the court motion, the main opposition Democratic Alliance, DA, and the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, EFF. Zuma's legal team admitted that the president was ready to pay back part of the money used to refurbish his home at Nkandla. But for the lawyers representing the two opposition parties, it was much more than just accepting to pay back the money. They argued that President Zuma did undermine the office of the public protector when he initially refused to pay the money as instructed. William Trengov, a member of the opposition's legal team, say they have a strong case against the president.
Every single matter that we wanted a ruling on has been now traversed in court, and we got the distinct impression, and certainly from the line of questioning of the justices, that we are going to get at least, if not all the orders we want, then at least the most important one.
President Zuma has faced mounting criticism since the Nkandla scandal started. Public protector Tulima Tonsela had carried out an investigation and found that the president benefited unduly by having a swimming pool, an amphitheater and chicken run shed built at his private home with state funds. Madonsela ordered Zuma to pay back part of the money. After months of denying any wrongdoing, Zuma said that he would pay back part of the money that did not relate to security upgrades. But the opposition, DA and EFF, wants South Africa's Constitutional Court to rule on whether President Jacob Zuma broke the law when he disobeyed the anti-graft agency. Outside the court, thousands of DA and EFF supporters received the news with jubilation, singing and chanting anti-Zuma songs and slogans. So Limsimanga is the provincial chairperson of the Democratic Alliance.
We are saying that Zuma cannot run this country like a republic of Zumaland. So a matter of principle is what brought us here today to say we will never rest until real justice has been served, to make sure that not only do we recover some of that money should be paid out of his own pockets.
One of the protesters, Nomvete Johanna, said by allowing over $15 million in public funds to be used on his home alone, Zuma lost all the credibility expected from a sitting president.
Now we want rule of law to take its course. In fact, as Congress of the People, we wish that he must just step down. He has failed and failed the country at large.
Experts say a ruling forcing Zuma to pay back the money could as well strengthen the position of those who want him impeached. The Constitutional Court, however, may take a few more days to come up with a decision.
Tuso Kumalo in Johannesburg. To find out how much damage the Nkandla case is doing to President Zuma, the ruling ANC and South Africa in general, my colleague Crispin Mwakidewo spoke to Daniel Silke, an independent political analyst.
Well, yes, this is ultimately a test of the constitutional democracy that is South Africa and is probably one of the most dramatic tests of the alleged abuse of power by the president in terms of the overspend on his personal residence versus, of course, what we call our Chapter 9 institutions, which is the Office of the Public Protector. It's a critical case in assessing just how far political leadership can go in terms of abusing their power and what kind of power does the public protector and her office have to try and counter this.
There are upcoming elections coming soon, and there were protests outside the court as the hearing went on. Could this case influence the outcome of these upcoming municipal elections?
Well, I don't think that the ruling African National Congress is in danger of losing its majority overall in terms of the local government elections, which are very important elections in South Africa. However, I think that the nature of the evidence we've seen today, the discussion between the various legal teams, including that of President Zuma's legal teams, leaves the president weakened and substantially weakened. The president has already been weakened on other matters, notably around the economy and the handling of our appointment of a finance minister, three finance ministers in 1 week, in fact, at the end of December. So the president comes off a weakened base, but I think the public discourse on this issue surrounding the excessive spend on his Nkandla home, the arguments put forward today, the fingers pointed at the president, and also the disconnect and disjointed way in which the office of the presidency has gone about to try and defend the president, all serves to weaken President Zuma. And whilst it may not have a direct electoral bearing over the next few months, I think it certainly affects the longevity of President Zuma's reign as president of South Africa and could very well see his reign shortened so as to avoid the extended period of time in which he could remain in office constitutionally until 2019. He could, in other words, be replaced earlier if the feeling within his own political party runs against him.
President Zuma was himself not in court when the hearing was going on, but can you see him appearing at a later date?
Well, he may be forced to at some later date. I think for the moment, the president will obviously avoid being in court, although he himself has always said he wants his day in court. But I think the president clearly has a very heavy political agenda this week. He is about to deliver the most important political speech of the year, which is the State of the Nation address on Thursday evening in South Africa, which sets the government's agenda. It also, in a sense, sets the scene for the local government elections, which he, of course, is the front face for his ruling political party.
Would you say that this Nkandla scandal is doing damage to the fabric of political life in South Africa, or would that be an exaggeration?
Now, I think it's doing damage to the ruling African National Congress, and it's doing damage to the brand of Jacob Zuma. But in fact, ironically, I think it is testimony to the very vibrant and relatively healthy state of the South African democracy, in that a sitting president can, in fact, be called to order by the Office of the Public Prosecutor, and that this matter can be heard fair and squarely in the highest court of the land, an objective constitutional court. In other words, I think it's rather a sorry state of affairs that we've got to this, but I think the mechanisms or the process in South Africa to handle this, I think, is testimony to a relatively robust democracy.
South African independent political analyst Daniel Silke.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
In Guinea-Conakry, it was an information blackout day. The country's 1.1 million people spent much of Tuesday with little information about what was happening in their own country. This came after five press associations called for a media blackout as a means to express their dissatisfaction over the manner in which the police treat them. Last week, police shot dead journalist Alhaji Mohamed Diallo. The 30-year-old was killed in the capital, Conakry, during clashes outside a meeting of an opposition party. Was this media blackout an appropriate response to Diallo's killing? Crispin Mwakdeo put this question to Carrie Patterson, Africa Research Associate at the Committee to Protect Journalists in New York.
The honest answer is that, you know, if journalists in the country want to take a stand for press freedom and want to say that it is unacceptable for journalists to be forced to work or perform their duties in unsafe conditions, then it, you know, it's absolutely their right to protest. And, you know, in some ways it's commendable that they see their profession and creating a blackout therein as sort of a means of maximizing their impact when doing so.
Would you say that this was an appropriate way to respond to this killing? I mean, that means also that other news or other matters are not being addressed today or during the period when the blackout is being carried out.
Of course. But, I mean, the reality is in the course of doing his work, Alhaji Mohamed Diallo was killed. You know, he was doing nothing but his job, and in the course of doing that job, he lost his life. It's totally understandable that, you know, journalists and supporters of press freedom would want to protest in support of, you know, improving the conditions facing those in the profession.
Now, according to media reports in the country, in Guinea, it is not clear who shot Diallo until now, but why would anyone have wanted him dead?
My understanding is that the local police have announced that they will be thoroughly investigating the murder, and that's a decision that we absolutely welcome. I think, you know, in terms of why someone is targeted, we don't know that he was targeted. It's possible that he was caught in the crossfire. I know there were clashes that broke out during a political meeting on the 5th. I think that, you know, if it was targeted, it's also not unusual that journalists are targeted for their work. In Guinea, throughout the past several years, we've seen a lot of sort of pressure put on the press, and whether that's journalists being threatened or radio stations being shut down or TV stations being told that they can't run what they want to.
Right. You just mentioned there that this isn't the first time that a journalist has been killed or that there has been some kind of attack on media freedom in Guinea. At the peak of the Ebola epidemic, I remember two journalists were brutally murdered and their bodies dumped into a septic tank in a rural village.
Yes, absolutely.
So how much a risk is practicing journalism in Guinea?
Unfortunately, it's too much of a risk. You know, that's not to say that you will absolutely face some sort of repression, but the reality is that we've documented several deaths over the past few years, and it's totally unacceptable that a journalist, in the course of informing the public and trying to hold power to account, sort of has to do so at the risk of their own lives. And as you rightly pointed out, it was actually a journalist and two media workers, so three, who were killed, you know, covering the Ebola education campaign in 2014. And so, in fact, it doesn't seem to matter if you're covering necessarily political news, as Diallo was last week. You know, this was a public health emergency that was being covered by journalists for the benefit of the public, and all three of them paid for it with their lives.
And what is the CPJ doing in terms of protecting journalists who are working in Guinea?
Well, CPJ sort of undertakes a number of things. Primarily, we're a research and advocacy organization, and so for the most part, what we're trying to do is monitor the situation closely and make sure that political officials and country officials know that we have, you know, an eye on the country, that we watch, that we are holding them to account to ensure that thorough investigations are launched where journalists are attacked or murdered, and that perpetrators are held to justice.
Crispin Mwakideo was speaking to Kari Patterson of CPJ in New York.
Behind the headlines.
In this week's Behind the Headlines, we go to Cameroon, where we meet Wakil Idi. The 34-year-old man comes from the Cameroonian-Nigerian border. This region has become a target of Boko Haram militants. Some youth often find the ideology of Boko Haram attractive and often opt to join the group. To avert this, Idi quit his job in a well-established company and created an information technology training center to empower the youth. But as Moki Kinseka reports, unemployment remains a huge challenge.
You are welcome to Kuseri to meet our hero. He is our hero. Ministers, meet our hero. These young teenagers have gathered here at Kuseri to sing praises of Wakil Idi. Idi is a 34-year-old who these youths call a living hero. Hassan Abashmir, a 36-year-old university graduate, describes how Idi helped him.
After I graduated from university in 2006, I was jobless for over 10 years. I wrote so many competitive entrance examinations to be recruited by the government of Cameroon, but I never succeeded. So I decided to come to Wakil Idi's Information Technology Training Center, and now I can take good care of my wife and three children.
Abashmir is one of about 200 young teenagers who have taken computer lessons at Idi's ICT Institute. High unemployment among these young teens in Kuseri drove most of them to look for job opportunities with the Nigerian Islamist sect Boko Haram. Idi says Boko Haram's recruiters convinced these youths by promising them huge salaries and the spoils of war.
Mais Boko Haram a suffisamment de l'argent pour amener ses enfants vers eux. Mais
I learned then that Boko Haram had enough resources at their disposal to easily manipulate unemployed youths and those they put out of work after destroying their businesses. I was informed that the terrorist group was offering up to about 5,500 for each important person they kidnapped or killed, and that was very tempting to poor, suffering and jobless
youths. Ils sont vides. Des jeunes qui avaient des motos. Non plus de moto.
Wakil Idi used to be one of these teens in Kuseri, but he left for the commercial capital Douala. If he had stayed any longer, when Boko Haram had their bases in the region, he could have been taken in and recruited. In Douala, Idi studied a degree in computer science maintenance. After his studies, he took a job for a few years, raised the amount he needed, and returned home. The beginning was very challenging, he says.
Je n'avais que quatre machines.
I had acquired four desktop computers before returning to Kuseri. Then I was asked to pay for rent that amounted to $130 a month. However, I was still not discouraged from my plans, which is to help young people in my hometown.
Et nous sommes en train de former d'autres jeunes.
30-year-old Tijia Jacob is now fully employed as a computer technician in the Chadian capital N'Djamena, which is just about a few kilometers away from the institute in Kuseri, Cameroon. Idi personally mentored Jacobs.
Après ma formation, il m'a dit de rester parce qu'il a vu je suis.
After receiving training, he asked me to remain at the center and teach other youths until I get a job. Thanks to the knowledge I acquired here, I can now feed my family.
Augmenter la formation et je sais avec ça, avec son aide, je serai quelqu'un comme lui aussi.
Currently, 75 teenagers are receiving computer training at Idi's ICT Center. When they graduate, they stay on and continue to train others until they find jobs. According to Wakil Idi, Boko Haram can not only be defeated by the guns, but also by providing education and job opportunities for vulnerable youths who are often both the victims and perpetrators of the violence. His computer lab is a good start that gives perspective to otherwise hundreds of potential terrorist recruits.
Moki Kinseka with that report. In Ghana, a debate has ensued over a government directive to stop public officials from pursuing further studies and limiting the number of foreign trips. To back up its argument, the government says that several officials neglect their duties by focusing on academic improvements. As Maxwell Sook reports, Ghanaians are divided over the issue.
All metropolitan, municipal and district chief executives, also known as MMDCs, pursuing academic courses while in office must stop their courses with immediate effect. That is the decision that Ghana's government has taken in order to get officials back to their offices. Some political analysts say the decision is unnecessary. Muniru Abdul Rashid is one of them.
From where I stand, it is an affront on their right to this personal development. You are an appointee does not make you a slave to the president. You being a DC should not limit your right to personal development. If I were a lawyer, I would have gone to court to stop that directive. You are limiting their right to personal development.
No reasons were given for the directive. But Richard Kambuta, head of the local government institute in Tamale, also thinks that there is nothing wrong with appointees taking courses. The Institute of Local Government is one of the centers that was created to help address local government challenges, and so many appointees enroll in these courses. According to him, the appointees are able to fulfill their duties while getting further training.
We often also organize residential training for them, but we ensure that work does not suffer, so we run it on model courses for them. So if the course is arranged in such a way that a DCE can go for a week, complete a model and come back and continue with his work, I don't necessarily see it as an issue that will affect delivery so much at the lower level.
Abudu Abdul Ganiu, a development consultant, however, thinks that such training should not be necessary in the first place. The officials, he says, should be equipped with the necessary skills to govern their town or district, and the president should simply make a better choice.
How does the president examine the CVs that are brought before him? How does the president look at the kind of experience, the skills that people are bringing to bear on whatever positions that he is appointing them to? These are the things that the president ought to be looking at, so that if the president appoints very experienced people, they are not going to waste a lot of productive hours going back to school to build their capacity.
At a national level, the directive also called on officials to cut down on foreign trips in order to curb government spending. Ghana's total debt stock stands at 94.5 billion cedis, that's about $31 billion, representing 70.9% of the country's gross domestic product. In December last year, the government decided that ministers who travel abroad should no longer get first-class tickets, although it's still unclear whether the ministers will actually follow that directive. Yusuf Danjuma, a political science student in Tamale, welcomes the idea.
Cutting down some of the trips will help. We'll reduce costs. You go and sleep in expensive hotels as ministers of state, go with your special assistant, go with your secretaries and so on. I don't think that is good enough for the development of a country that still needs development like this country. So the directive is good, but the president should demonstrate some level of responsibility as the leader of the country and cut down his trips first for the ministers of state to follow.
As the government tackles the inefficiencies and spending issues, it remains to be seen whether these measures will actually work. However, a bill aimed at stopping ministries, departments and agencies, MDAs, from overspending their budgets and sanctioning them is being developed by the Finance Ministry. The Fiscal Responsibility Bill is geared towards sanctioning MDAs who expand beyond their budget resilience.
Maxwell Sook reporting.
Opinion.
In this week's Opinion, we shall break with tradition and bring you another story apart from the ones that we've aired. Kenya has threatened to boycott the Rio 2016 Olympics over fears of the Zika virus. When asked by DW whether this had anything to do with the doping allegations by Kenyan athletes, long-serving athletes Kenya chairman Isaiah Kiplengat had this to say.
That is nonsense. If we were trying to hide ourselves, how come our athletes are still taking part in different sporting events around the world? Kenyan athletes are not concerned by the doping allegations at all.
Kenya's long-serving athletes Primo Isaiah Kiplengat. What about you? What is your opinion on Kenya's concerns about the Zika virus at the Rio Olympics? Send us your thoughts on either of the stories or any other that we've shared. You have the opportunity to send a text message to +491609575950. You can also send us an email to feedback.africa@dw.com or a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. And we will air some of your thoughts on Friday. And now, a reminder of our top stories. South Africa's Constitutional Court has conducted a hearing into President Jacob Zuma's Nkandla case. Guinean journalists have observed a press-free day in response to the killing of one of their colleagues. And we've also been hearing about the efforts of one Cameroonian man to fight terror recruitment. Thank you for listening. Africa Link returns tomorrow, same time. For now, I'm Jane Ayeko Kumet saying, have a pleasant day. We'll be right back.